Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Indeed, today is the day. If you're just joining us, maybe you don't yet know, it is the 30th day of April. It's the last day of April, and I encourage people in the first hour to be fools. April fools, the right kind, fools for Christ. So just a little encouragement today to not be people who are wise in the ways of the world so much as with the very spiritual wisdom of the Lord our God. All right, there's a lot of hate in the headlines today, and it just coming at us from lots of different directions and angles. And so let's kill it with kindness with Nicole Phillips. Nicole, you got a kindness story for us today?
Oh, you know it. You know it. I really believe that kindness begins to flourish in our lives when we live by the words that what you look for is what you'll see. If all you're looking at is the negative headlines and you constantly got, you know, the TV on in the background, you are being inundated with these messages. So I got an email from a man named Harvey Lobbs, and he said he and his wife were traveling to Washington, D.C. a few days ago, and they took the metro from the airport to the stop near their hotel. Well, they get on the metro and they realize, you know, he said, I'm 76 years old, and I realize I don't exactly know how to use the metro. And so they were worried they were going in the wrong direction, and he and his wife are sitting on the train talking about it. And a woman leans forward from sitting behind them and says, you're going in the right direction and your stop is, you know, five stops from now. And then when they got to the stop before theirs, the woman got off. But before she got off, she stopped and she looked him in the eye and she said, your stop is going to be the next one. Mm. And, you know, he felt really loved by that. And I think there are two sides to this. Number one, Harvey saw the kindness happening around him. He wasn't so caught up in the fact that, oh, I don't know where I'm going, or, you know, it's scary in this big city. He saw the kindness happening to him in that moment. And the flip side of it is the woman saw a really easy way to be kind, and she acted on it. So she was probably looking for some way to be kind, and what you look for is what you see. And so that's what I would encourage people today, to go out and really let kindness flourish in your life by looking for it.
So on Friday, my best friend since high school was on the show. Her name's Jessica, and Jessica lives by this like bolo attribute. So she calls it be on the lookout. And I think that's what that's basically what you're saying, right? Like, be on the lookout constantly for opportunities. And then for people who do demonstrate kindness, like the woman on the train that you're describing, like, had I been there and missed the opportunity to do the initial kindness, the kindness to her is then to acknowledge that you caught her doing something good, right? So let's also be like the second wave in there that catches other people doing acts of kindness and sort of, you know, encourage that by simply acknowledging it.
Every time I see someone being kind, I scream, kindness!
Oh, see, that's so great.
My kids constantly are rolling their eyes, Mom!
That's so great.
People need to know.
That's so great. Hey, you guys can get more at NicoleJPhillips.com. Go fill up on some kindness today. Nicole, thank you again so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Carmen.
Thanks.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of years without crying.
Joining me now, Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. You can find them on Twitter at CMDA National. Dr. Stevens, welcome back.
It's good to be with you.
So we talked at the opening of the first hour a little bit about H.R. 5, also known as the Equality Act. And so I'm looking forward to having your perspective on that. Just to remind people that H.R. 5 is a proposal before Congress which would turn sexual orientation and gender identity into protected classes under the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1968 Fair Housing Act. So what are your concerns about the Equality Act from the medical perspective?
Well, first of all, the name, because you see verbal engineering always goes along with social engineering. There's nothing about equality here. In the sense, this is a bill to force people to conform their ideology to the LGBT community. We've dealt with this already because under that last administration, there was a regulation that came out that affected every Christian healthcare professional in the country, and it essentially said this: if you provided a procedure or a medication for anyone, you had to provide it to an LGBT person on demand. So therefore, if parents brought in an 11-year-old who thought they were transgender, you had to give them hormone blockers so they wouldn't go through puberty, and then cross-sex hormones, giving estrogen to boys and testosterone to biological girls. You had to, if you did a mastectomy for breast cancer, you had to do that surgery for a woman who wanted to be a man. And of course, this is not only bad medicine and harmful and disfiguring and all the other things that go along with it, but it violates our religious beliefs and our medical knowledge because we know these hormones are very harmful when you give them cross-sex. Causes memory deficits, brittle bones, infertility, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, gallstones. The list just goes on. So we actually sued the federal government and got an injunction that stopped this across the whole country. Now this equality law will essentially do the same thing and will have a much wider impact than even the regulation, including people be able to use bathrooms of the opposite sex if they're transgender, dressing rooms, and other things like that. So this is very broad. It's going to terrifically impact healthcare. 95% of our 20,000 members say that they would quit medicine before they violate their conscience. So this is going to get down to losing healthcare professionals, especially those who have faith like our members do.
Give us just sort of maybe tell us, I recognize that some of it is speculative, but like tell us the kind of story we would be hearing if H.R. 5 passes and becomes the law of the land and it is criminalized. Well, what would it criminalize for doctors and other healthcare professionals, or what would it compel them to do against their conscience if they were going to abide by the new law?
Well, there's already two instances of that because some states have passed similar laws, California, New Jersey, and California. They've brought a suit against the Catholic hospital system because a doctor wouldn't do a hysterectomy on a woman who wanted to be a man. The same thing happened in New Jersey. What would happen to healthcare professionals, the penalty for what they proposed with this regulation, it's the same in the act, is that you would lose your Medicaid funding, your Medicare funding, and your license, and you could be sued by the patient for even using the non-preferred pronoun. So if you call a biological male who thinks they're a woman he instead of she, you could be sued and have draconian penalties. Essentially, you could not exist and practice as a healthcare professional. And this is not just physicians. It's everyone in healthcare. Well, this is now going to be extended to the general population, this type of draconian type of approach. It's scary what could happen with this. And as soon as these bangs have happened in other states, they immediately try to make test cases to scare people. There have already been a doctor sued because he used the wrong pronoun in California. So this is big stuff that would fundamentally change how we are in this country and fundamentally change healthcare. We're seeing a lot of pressure already on our members. I have a chief of psychiatry at a major medical school who lost his job because he actually worked with Alliance Defending Freedom and testified on a bathroom use issue in North Carolina, and they forced him out. He'd been there for years. So this is a big deal. This isn't just what could happen. We're already seeing it happen.
Okay, I want to also talk with you after the break about this announcement by the federal government about a new Part D model for Medicare. And because I think that there's just a lot of people that don't know what the protected classes of prescriptions are and how those would be eliminated by this. I think that there's a major conversation to be had here that lots of folks are simply not having. So if we can turn there and then... And then we're going to give people an update on the measles outbreak. So I am talking with Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. He and I will be right back. So every time we talk about the measles outbreak here, I get a lot of feedback. So I recognize if you are an anti-vaxxer and you are listening right now, you don't like this conversation. So you can tell me that again if you want to, but we're going to actually talk about it again anyway. So Dr. Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association, give us an update on the measles outbreak.
Well, there'll be about 900 cases so far in this country. In 2000, they declared that measles have been wiped out. These cases have come from overseas, and measles is a very, very contagious disease. You can get it for 4 days before you get a fever, pass it on to other people, and 4 days afterwards. So it's highly contagious. The virus can even stay in the air for a couple hours, and you can just breathe it in. So you can see why people get it on planes coming back from other countries and all the rest of it. Our immunization levels have dropped in certain areas, and measles is not an innocuous disease. One out of four people who get it end up in the hospital. One out of 1,000 with measles actually get encephalitis and inflammation of the brain, which can have long-term problems. And about one out of 2 out of 1,000 actually die of the disease. I've probably had more experience taking care of measles than any doctor in the U.S. in recent years, because I used to take care of a whole ward full of measles complications when I was a missionary doctor. And I've seen what it can do through pneumonia, at the high fevers that go up over 104, and the things that can happen. So it's a bad disease. One of the things now we're talking about actually is older people needing measles vaccine, because there were some people born back down 1957 through about 64 where the measles vaccine didn't work very well and probably should be immunized. And people that aren't sure about their immunization, it's pretty innocuous immunization, and a couple of those, and it's about 97% effective. So especially if you're thinking about getting pregnant, measles is deadly for children in pregnancy and causes disabilities, poor birth weight, and even sometimes miscarriages. So if someone's thinking about getting pregnant and don't know their measles vaccine status, I would encourage them to go ahead and get that vaccine.
So I've been intrigued by these cases in California at these two universities. I will tell you that I was kind of surprised that that vaccination is actually, it must not be a requirement for attending college. It is a requirement for lots of public schools across the country. And so is there anything that has been curious to you, or am I kind of alone in imagining that that public institutions where people live in real proximity to one another and from the global community, should I not be surprised that we have a measles outbreak at public universities?
Well, all people don't go to public schools. Some go to private schools, some homeschool, and some, and the reason they don't have vaccination, there's a 3% failure rate on getting the vaccine, even if you do it properly. So some of those people, we have what's called herd immunity. Herd immunity means if you get enough people vaccinated, the chance of it being able to be passed on to someone else decreases. That person gets over their measles, and that's the end of it. But as herd immunity decreases, the percentage of people with vaccine increases, then this thing can go very quickly, and especially where people are in close contact, in a dormitory, in a schoolroom, on an airplane. This is just in the air because someone's coming down with it. They don't have the rash yet. They don't feel good, red watery eyes, a cough, maybe it's a cold. And they're passing on the measles vaccine to, I mean, the measles virus to everyone in the room. So because this is so contagious is one of the reasons that you see these clusters of cases and the problems that happen from it.
Okay, so now let's do a little medical 101. Remind us what a virus is.
Yeah, there's bacteria and there are viruses. Viruses are not cured by antibiotics. You know, only can treat the symptoms of the disease. We have some antivirals that you can get for the flu and that type of thing, but measles sneaks up on you and there's no real way to prevent it even after you've been exposed except to go ahead and give the vaccination. Viruses can, because they're difficult to treat once you get them, can be deadly. We think of viruses as colds and flu and things like that. But measles is a particularly bad one. I came across a picture the other day, and here I was, all three of my us as children were in one bedroom, all of us down with the measles, and Mom had put us all together so she could do better nursing. And I remember it as a real miserable time. It's no fun to go through the disease, and the high fevers of over 104 degrees are pretty scary, especially for caregivers.
So now that we have people listening right now who are now saying to themselves, see, he had measles, his siblings had measles, he's okay. I watched the Brady Bunch, that whole family had measles all at the same time, and it was a good time was had by all. Talk with us about how the environment has changed maybe and how our resistance to such things maybe has changed and how our understanding of these things has changed over the last 30, 40, 50 years.
Well, back when I was having measles in the early 1950s, 4 million people a year had measles because we had no vaccine. So it wasn't a matter of can we prevent this. We still had deaths. We still had hospitalizations. We still had pneumonia. And most people with measles recover. But it is not an innocuous disease. One out of four people, you have four children, one of them's likely to be in the hospital. And you're going to be dealing with that and the bill that goes along with it. And you might be the one that gets the pneumonia. You may be the one that ends up with the encephalitis, your child. So it's not an innocuous disease. Brady Bunch was an idolized situation back in the days when we also had, polio and all sorts of things that were much worse than measles. So it's easy to kind of say, well, it's not that bad. But polio is something we don't see anymore. But measles is still here. It's coming back. And the more people that are unimmunized, the bigger the problem we're going to see. So it needs to be dealt with. And the vaccine is not that expensive. It covers not only measles, but mumps and whooping cough, other diseases that you need to be prevented. And so I encourage people to get it. You have the right not to get it. A lot of places you can have an exemption and all the rest of it. But if enough people take the exemption from getting the vaccine, before long, we're going to have a serious problem in the country. And we're beginning to see that.
Okay. Can you give us a quick update on what has happened in Kansas at the Supreme Court level related to abortion?
They voted 6-1 that abortion was a legal right in the state, and they said that any kind of requirements on women wanting to have an abortion will have to undergo strict scrutiny. That's much more strict than what we have under the U.S. Constitution. In other words, waiting periods, ultrasounds, all those type of things. This is going to strike down everything, any protection for women considering an abortion in the state. And it's probably one of the more radical state steps, similar to what New York, Virginia, and others have taken in the last year. So there's a lot of concern about that. And this is a pro-life state. Now they're moving towards trying to get an amendment to the Constitution to prohibit abortion in the state, or at least severely limit it.
So that's a case that we're going to watch, and we'll continue to follow up with you on it. Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association, thank you again so much. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay, thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Really appreciate it. All right, friends, we got Breakpoint up next. Well, a person familiar with parody, Peter Kapsner, is up next. He is going to be here in what he and I are calling the 50 Shades of Truth segment. So we don't actually think there are 50 shades of gray out there, or maybe there are, but there are definitely lots of different conversations that we need to be having surrounding the truth. The truth is being actively suppressed in the culture. We would like to lift the veil on all of that and equip you to walk out there into the conversations of the day informed and prepared to bring God back into every conversation. So Peter Kapsner is up next, and he and I are going to talk about pressing the mind of Christ into the matters of the day. Okay, so this is like a grab your pen and pencil moment. Or if you have your phone handy and you can like talk text to yourself even while I'm talking. May the 21st is the Rise Up Business Leaders Breakfast. And you need to go to unwsp.edu and sign up. Now, why? Well, because our friend and my favorite conversation partner, Peter Kapsner, is going to be speaking there on that day. So live and in person. So May the 21st, the Rise Up Business Leaders Breakfast. Go to UNWSP. That stands for the University of Northwestern at St. Paul. UNWSP.edu. And Peter Kapsner is here with us in studio. Well, he's actually in studio with Paul Perreault. I'm not in that same studio, but we're together on air in just a minute.
Sure, not every kid is destined to rule a country or run a Fortune 500 company, but every kid can be a leader. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Leaders are those who govern themselves. They're not mindless followers. They're secure in what they know is right, and they walk in the truth regardless of whether others come with them. Now, that's the type of person we want our sons or daughters to become. But how can parents raise leaders in their own home? It all starts with setting the example. Mom and Dad, show your teen how to do the right thing even when it's hard, and to stay calm under pressure and to treat others with respect. Leadership is caught, not taught. So if you want to raise a leader, you have to be one first.
Want more help from Mark Gregston? Check out his latest resources online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
Try to never lie on air to the people. But they if they go to unwsp.edu and they don't put in a / rise up, it's really hard to find where to sign up and get tickets for the Rise Up Business Leaders Breakfast where Peter Kapsner is speaking on May the 21st. So go to unwsp.edu/rise up. Here with us now, Peter Kapsner. Drum roll. Woohoo. Hi, man.
Good morning, Carmen. Thanks for pumping that that breakfast. I'm actually really excited to be a part of that.
I don't want you to be there by yourself.
Well, you know, I do. Now, I will get up on any given morning, Carmen. You know this. And I can just look in the mirror. I find myself so terribly interesting that I can hold my attention for a half an hour minimum when I'm brushing my teeth.
I think like 2 minutes. You're only supposed to brush your teeth for 2 minutes. Like I think your dentist would say 30 minutes is too long.
Yeah, I have rubbed off the enamel. There's no question in this whole deal. So
you and I are supposed to be talking about substantive matters.
We are.
So
we are.
I would like to talk with you about the fragile. Like this is actually serious. So, which you and I can move around in conversations from the humorous to the serious pretty quickly. So we're going to dive deep here. John Singleton, whose name many people will know, but lots of people may not immediately recognize. He gives us an opportunity to talk about the fragility of life and, I think, the what a life that is pressed into a particular issue, like how much impact you can really have in this world. So John Singleton, for those of you who don't know, suffered a stroke on April the 17th. And yesterday, his life came to an end when his family removed life support. You would recognize John Singleton as a Hollywood producer. For those of us who grew up in the Boys in the Hood age and generation, we certainly recognize the way in which John Singleton changed the conversations that we were having by taking us right into the realities of urban life on the street. And so let's just talk about John Singleton and the impact of one human life.
Yeah, I think, Carmen, you nailed it. And there's a couple different directions we could go with this, I think. And that is the fragility of life that you mentioned at 51 years old. Seemingly steaming through life and suddenly has a stroke and has passed away. And it's made me reflect on legacy a little bit in the sense that what does it mean to leave a legacy behind? And specifically, what does it mean to leave a legacy behind in which you probably aren't remembered by the next generations that are benefiting from your legacy? Because I would suggest to you that many of my students that are in my undergraduate programs, a generation or two behind me and you, would not be as familiar with his name, because it was 1991 that Boys in the Hood came out and made such a tremendous social impact as it shined the spotlight on some pretty troubling and often hidden realities, because this was pre-internet. We didn't have 24-hour news cycles that were constantly covering all of these different angles of the story. And I don't think we as a country, I certainly don't think we as a church, had a sort of a social conscious understanding of the difficulty of life in the inner city. And so maybe we can go to that in just a minute. But in terms of legacy, he really shined the spotlight. And so much of the way we think about conversation now, so many of the conversations we have about social justice and about racial issues, really, he did such a great job bringing that to the surface. And so my young people don't even know, perhaps, the impact that that movie and what he did is having in their conversations now. So I don't know about you, Carmen. I find life goes by way more quickly than I would have guessed. People used to tell me at 20 and 30 that you're going to be 50 and 60 and 70 before you know it, and I just would sort of blow them off. But it's really true, and I think most of us want to leave something of significance behind. But there is a big difference between leaving something behind and being remembered for leaving something behind. And if you and I and our listeners are trying to be remembered into the future, that probably is not going to happen. But that doesn't mean we can't make significant impact in the generations to come based on the work we do in the present.
I'm interested as well in all of these young African-American Hollywood figures who, you know, are now sharing how this man impacted their lives. And so I do think that the testimony of others, how is it that people testify about us when we're gone, that is almost all that remains.
It really is. You know, you look at the celebration, and understandably so, of a movie like Black Panther, part of the Avengers universe that came out last year and was widely acclaimed in Hollywood, seemed to be well-received by any race or ethnic background, really enjoyed this movie. And it very much was a celebration of African and African-American culture in the context of a superhero story. And I would suggest, Carmen, we wouldn't have had the chance to appreciate that movie absent of what Singleton did back in 91 in this Boys in the Hood that just made such an impact. He was just 24 years old. He was this young screenwriter, and somebody offered him $100,000 to take the script and sort of rewrite what he wanted to do. And he said, nope, this is my movie. This is coming from sort of, you know, the inside out. He had this passion, and he had this vision and focus for what he wanted to highlight in the African-American community, especially on the heels of so many of the riots that were happening and some of what was taking place with Rodney King and the white police officers who were acquitted in some of that. It was just such a crazy time, and he really brought some important things to the forefront.
So as Hollywood mourns director John Singleton, it is an opportunity for us to consider what breaks down barriers, what breaks people's hearts, what breaks misconceptions, and to be people who are testifying to who Jesus is, living our lives in ways that, you know, it's not about making a kingdom unto ourselves or making a name for ourselves, but it is about making the name of Jesus great. And so today, as you are walking your faith out into the world that God so loves, as you seek to leave a legacy, you know, how are you going to be remembered? And what about you is going to testify to the goodness and greatness of God? How are you going to sow peace into the lives of others? And today, what kind of barriers are you going to break down? Like, those are questions that are before us because of the life and death of John Singleton. Those will be conversations being had today in the culture. And Peter and I are simply trying to give you a way to enter into those conversations in ways that honor Jesus. Peter Kapsner and I will be right back. We're going to talk about the United Methodist Church. So if you've been paying attention to the headline news related to denominations here in the United States of America, you know that the United Methodist Church is in a brouhaha following the similar conversations had among other liberal mainline Protestant denominations. And now I think that the UMC would say, hey, hey, don't count us in that group. We are doing what no other mainline Protestant denomination has been able to do, and that is to resist the advocacy of LGBTQ people in changing the church's standards related to leadership and marriage. And so here's what's going on. On Friday, the Judicial Commission of the United Methodist Church, this is the denomination's highest court, upheld the key provisions of something called the traditional plan. And that is a policy that upholds what we would describe as traditional Christian teaching on sexuality. And they also upheld the gracious exit policy, which would enable dissenting churches to leave while still retaining their property. This is huge news in terms of mainline Protestantism in the United States. And here to talk with us about it is Peter Kapsner.
It is huge news, Carmen. I think this is the first example I know of a denomination that is being as proactive as they are in terms of upholding the traditional views of family and marriage. And I think what's going to happen is there are several other denominations, and I'm sure you know our listeners know if they're part of some of these denominations, that are walking through the very same conversation. And up until what we've seen in the United Methodist Church, when these conversations start, they tend to end almost in one way. It's sort of this slow walk towards an embrace of the LGBT community, and we begin to embrace same-gender marriages. And in this particular situation, the United Methodist Church has provided a bit of an example that other denominations can almost have a bit of political and social cover and say, hey, they went this direction and they upheld the traditional family values. And so maybe we can think in those terms as well today. And so there's certainly, again, there's a couple denominations of which I know that are in the heat of this very same issue. And I've been involved in some church meetings and some places with pastors where, boy, there's a lot of energy on it. And I don't think we can underestimate the impact of what we've just seen in the United Methodist Church.
So the United Methodist Church is the second largest Protestant denomination in the country, second only to the Southern Baptist Convention, which is technically not a denomination, so maybe the Methodists are the largest. And when Peter is talking about other denominations, here's the truth of the matter. The Episcopal Church, the ELCA Lutherans, so that would be the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, and the Presbyterian Church USA, PCUSA, those are national bodies that have not done what the United Methodist Church has just done. So those denominations all fully embraced the LGBTQ advocacy. They changed their ordination standards. They changed their standards related to marriage. And thousands of congregations then sought to leave those denominations. And those denominations did not do what the Methodist Church has now done, which is to say, if you want to leave, we'll let you go. Please go without fomenting any more trouble and take your property with you. No other denomination has done this. Every other denomination has not only embraced the LGBTQ agenda, but then held a hard line in terms of allowing congregations to leave with their property. So on every level, the United Methodist story is different than these other stories. I think that that is true, Peter, because the United Methodist Church is unique in that it's global. And so those influencing this conversation are global Christians, not exclusively Western or American Christians. Why does that matter?
Yeah, that's something, Carmen, I would say we need to spend several months now mining into. When you look at this from the perspective of sociology and you ask the question, so why was there such a split or such a fracture between African, Asian, Latino communities within the United Methodist Church and more of the Caucasian, wealthy Western vote? Because the vote when the United Methodist Church took this vote was very much split along those kinds of lines. And I was on a plane down to Disney World last November or so, and there's a few empty seats next to us. We were waiting for whoever those people might be to get on the plane. And of all people, it turned out to be a really good friend of mine who is a pastor in the United Methodist Church. And he said some of this. He was in the midst of the vote, and he said, you know, Peter, this conversation about LGBTQ and advocacy and embrace of really is significantly related to white, Western, wealthy, Caucasian people. And if you begin to mine into this a little bit, Carmen, and this is part of what I've been speaking about in churches lately, too, and helping to understand what some of the dynamics are, is in the last 2,000 years, you don't see a religious tradition. I'm not talking just a Christian tradition. I'm talking any religious tradition, whether it be Muslim or Buddhist or Jewish or any Christian denomination, ever embracing same gender relationships. This is unique in world history over the last 5 or 6 years within American religious culture that there would be an embrace of same gender relationships. And so the question is did we finally just get smarter? Did we understand God's truth in a different kind of way that remains truthful? Or is there something else going on that would explain the rise and subsequent embrace of LGBTQ relationships? And what we've been talking about and at least exploring, Carmen, is that the primary sort of slogan of American individualistic, empowered white culture is you can be whatever you want to be. And that's sort of what we tell our kids. It's what we develop their resumes around. We spend a lot of energy as families and as parents trying to help empower our kids with this underpinning, this message, you can be whatever you want to be. It's very much an individualistic message. I think there's some reason for the message. But if we're not careful, we end up sort of creating an environment for our kids that you make all the decisions, you decide whatever you want to do and wherever you want to be. And I don't know about you, Carmen, but I don't find anywhere in the biblical text where that is the invitation to us. And in fact, when you read the invitation of God's beautiful kingdom, people like Paul say things like, I'm actually a bondservant of the king. My life is not my own. It's been purchased with a price. I am not here to be whatever I want to be. I am here in service of the king of a kingdom. And you and I were just talking about legacy. It's only within that kingdom that we leave legacy behind, that we continue this great story of faith that we've been a part of for these 2,000 years. So all of that's to say, I think you and I and others could spend several months exploring the difference between you can be whatever you want to be culture and some of the good of that, but the downside and the subtle downside of that versus life in the kingdom in which we surrender our lives for something bigger and for the sake of the kingdom.
In order to do that, we're going to need Paul Perreault to find us some Burger King Have It Your Way music so that we can set our conversations up and set a little hook in people's minds that that's the direction that we're going.
When do you need that?
Yeah, well, maybe by the next time Peter's on.
Okay. Yeah, I expect a cheeseburger done my way when I come into studio, just to highlight this on a visual perspective.
Because
I could also do Mr. Blunt if you wish.
Nice. Even the idea that you could walk into Burger King and have it your way is within a set of given parameters.
That's exactly right.
You cannot. Yeah. So we got to operate in that. Okay. You and I have to probably leave it right there. Peter Kapsner is on with me every single week. We've moved him to Tuesdays. So that's today. So thank you for joining us in studio. We love talking with you. Peter and I are going to continue peeling back the onion on this particular issue week after week. Let us know what you're thinking about and how you're thinking about it. You can always text us at 877-933-2484. You can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Peter, thanks, man.
Always great to be with you, Carmen. Favorite part of the week.
Whatever you do today, do it as unto the Lord. You're going to hear today about a high-profile resignation from the Trump administration. Rod Rosenstein has resigned. It's a good opportunity to talk about that word and to talk about work and to talk about our worth and to talk about what we do every day and how we do it. Pray today for people who are in job transitions. I have a friend named Rachel who's in a job transition, and I am actively praying for her. As she discerns the future filled with hope that God has planned for her. There's lots of folks who are underemployed, unemployed, and would maybe prefer to be doing something different. And so if you're one of those people, know that you are on my heart and in my prayers today. Let's be reaching out to folks who are in job transitions so that they're not resigned from the conversation, even if they are resigning from their jobs. So there you go, a little conversation hook for the day. Have a great day, and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.